How many times has this happened to you? You said, what I need is a great podcast on books. Well, it's here. Chatter on Books, and it starts right now. I'm Jamie McIntyre, your part-time announcer, and here's your full-time host, Tori Clark.
This is the first one in a few weeks we haven't done live for our Patreon patrons. I'm kind of missing Patty and Robert, but it's okay. Okay. All right, we are rolling. Welcome back to Chatter on Books, everybody. Hope you're doing well, staying healthy. I'm finally off a plane, which I seem to have been doing for the last 4 days straight, coming back from Argentina. And tonight we have award-winning Claude Jennings doing all the important work. David Aldridge is wrapping up 3 days in Cleveland for the All-Star weekend. And so we are very, very happy to have Jamie McIntyre and back our favorite celebrity mixologist, Rodney Ferguson. Welcome back, guys. Great to have you with us.
Thank you.
Rodney, I'm not sure when we're going to talk about the drink, which you have crafted for tonight's book, but we will talk about it. And I need to be really careful with this drink.
Yeah, whenever you're ready. I would say go, you know, pace. Hey, like everything else in life, pace is all about pace.
Yeah.
And we can talk about it when appropriate.
And we are going to be talking about the drink because we are going to be talking in just a little bit with Xochitl Gonzalez, who has written this incredible novel, Olga Dies Dreaming. Heard about this book from Ron Charles, Washington Post book critic, who's a fabulous guy. It is a wonderful book. It is a start to read it. Don't put it down. And Rodney has crafted a wonderful drink that goes along with the essence of the story. But we have to do a few things. One, because I've pestered so many of our listeners about, please go to Apple iTunes and write nice reviews. And they have. And I just very quickly want to thank, I'm going to use whatever they use on their Apple iTunes review. This is Milwinick, maybe that's how you pronounce it, who said, love this quirky, opinionated, fast-moving podcast that is ostensibly about books. I just love it when I read that because I thought that's what I wanted this to be about. Ostensibly about books, but about a lot of other things. But also about sports and anything that might come up along the way. The hosts are appallingly smart. Love that. Accomplished and erudite. Well worth a listen. And Dr. B. Savvy calls it the go-to podcast for books. So thank you guys so much. Everybody, again, in all your spare time. I know you don't have much, but the reviews do help. So please go to Apple iTunes. Okay, Rodney, you are the head of a global nonprofit, hopefully coming out of the pandemic. Is that how you feel? Is that how you're experiencing things these days?
I think the answer is yes, mostly. We are seeing some of the old patterns return. We're traveling again, not extensively yet, but we are traveling. I've got a potential trip to Africa in a couple weeks, and my senior staff particularly are traveling a bit. All my staff are beginning to sort of travel. So that's back. The big question mark is who's coming back to the office. It's sort of like guess who's coming to dinner. Guess who's coming to the office today? Now I should say our organization set up a permanent, for the most knock on wood for the time being, remote working policy. So people can choose in perpetuity whether they want to work remotely or not. And so we're sort of waiting to see how many people are going to decide to come back to the office. We don't know. I would suspect about a quarter will come back, and or between a quarter and 40% will come occasionally or a lot. But we don't know. That's the shoe that's yet to drop.
But those are huge implications. I may have talked about this on the show before, but I used to work for SAP, big German software company, offices around the world. And just in the year or two before the pandemic hit, was going around the world buying up really expensive real estate, largely in cool, hip cities like Berlin, and, you know, go to Singapore and go to Shanghai and go to these great places and buy this incredible real estate because you were trying to attract the best and brightest young people in tech. So, of course, you had to have these great offices.
Right.
And now something like 85% of the SAP employees go, yeah, don't really need that anymore. Thank you very much. Right. I mean, some do, but I think you're right. It's the other shoe to drop. Jamie, coming out of the pandemic, my friend. Let's see the other hand. Let's see the other hand. How's it going? Nice.
I have a compression glove I wear on my hand because I burned my hand late last year. Has actually become my friend. It's I thought I was going to be really bummed out that they told me I would have to wear this glove for about a year while my hand and skin graft healed where I got third degree burns on my hand, but it's actually, it really protects my hand and makes it really comfortable. And it kind of looks cool. It looks like I have a bionic hand on my left hand. So I'm okay with it.
If we have a show on creepy horror thrillers or something like that, you can come on and do that. Okay. I said before the show, we're going to put you on the spot. Put on your CNN headlines head. So this isn't Claude. I think we should give him a minute to tell us about what's about to happen in Ukraine, why we should care, and what would the United States do about it?
All right.
Okay.
So, you know,
that's a lot in a minute, Tori.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's CNN headlines version, Rod.
Yeah.
All right. So the big debate over the last couple of weeks is, what would Putin do? Would he blink? Would he try to take over all of Ukraine? Would he try to take over bits and pieces of it? And we still don't know. But we, at the time that we're recording this conversation, the Russian president has signed an executive order recognizing the sort of breakaway areas of eastern Ukraine, the Donetsk and the area generally known as the Donbass, where they already have Russian separatists battling the Ukraine government. He's sending Russian troops in. We don't know if it stops there, but this is the red line that the Biden administration drew, no further incursion or invasion into Ukraine. And of course, in 2014, Russia illegally annexed the Crimea. So this should trigger a whole round of sanctions. At the time we're talking, the Biden administration has just said they're going to impose some limited sanctions that affect that particular area. I guess they're hoping that Putin will stop there. But, you know, where this goes from here, we just don't know. This has been a high stakes poker game where, you know, we couldn't figure out for a while if Putin was bluffing. And then we figured out if he was bluffing, it was the most expensive bluff in, you know, the 20th century, because the cost of amassing 190,000 troops encircling Ukraine was tremendous. So we're in a very perilous time right now. We don't know what's going on. It's going to affect world energy prices. And it also affects the, you know, the basic premise, the basic value that people can't change other countries' borders by threat of force or actual force.
You got, it's about 2 minutes, right, Claude?
The minute 50. Yeah, minute 50, minute 52.
Okay. Yep, excellent, Jamie.
If I was on CNN, someone would be yelling in my ear, rap, rap, rap. Wolf has to get to the next guest. Wrap it up.
I have one comment, then I want to ask Rodney about how this is impacting his organization's business around the world. But I keep hearing people refer to it as what Putin is doing, and not negotiations, but dealing with the United States on this, is this high-stakes poker game. High-stakes poker is when somebody cares what the other guy's hand is. Putin doesn't care. You know, we look at this issue and we frame it up in terms of what we care about, and we would care about sanctions, and we would care about these things. I believe almost the more we object, and the more we and other countries, allies, object to this, and the more we impose sanctions, the stronger, the more it enhances him domestically in Russia. I don't see, from his perspective, I don't see downsides. I hope I'm wrong. But Rodney, again, global organization, nonprofit organization, worried about it, impacts?
Yeah, no, we are worried about it, and for reasons that may not be obvious at first blush. But, you know, we're in about 45 countries around the world, right? And we're in some countries where there are some really bad actors, and we have to operate in those countries. What things like this do, situations like this, and I know it sounds, this is harkening back to our prime, Tory and Jamie, back in the old, you know, 80s, 90s days, it's empowering authoritarians in a way that we see the results of this in real time. And for the last, and there are other domestic political situations that have contributed to this as well, but when authoritarians around the world and bad actors in countries that are already fairly unstable see that there's a reward for aggression and a reward for complete disregard for international rule of law, anti-corruption measures, et cetera, guess what? They will act on those impulses. And we see it in ways small, big and small, in countries that what is normal, but under normal circumstances would be reluctant to do bad things. We see they now feel as though they can act with more impunity. And that affects organizations like ours in terms of the level of corruption goes up, the level of coercion goes up, and it makes it harder to operate around the world. And you know, Putin is developing. You know, he's got like a Mar-a-Lago or a Aspen Institute of authoritarians, right? They're looking forward to getting together and over some cocktails and some suntan lotion and talking about what do we do next, Vlad? You know, we're ready to go.
Hey, Rodney, can you just remind those of us who knew but forgot exactly what your nonprofit organization
does? Oh, sure, Jamie. We're Windrock International. We're an international development organization. We do a number of different. We're not a one trick pony. We do agricultural development. We do energy and environment and climate change work. We do counter-trafficking. We're the largest implementer of U.S.-funded counter-trafficking work in the world. And then we also have a domestic program that does economic development, primarily in the South, working with disadvantaged populations. So it's a broad portfolio, but about 90% of our work is international. And we're a $100 million a year organization. So, you know, that's why we have an interesting view into other countries and their behaviors all over the world.
Thank you, Jamie. And I just want to point out, this is the first time, I think, in history, Claude, that we spent the first 10-15 minutes of the show not talking about sports.
No, exactly. This is definitely a change of pace, isn't it?
Okay.
So, you know, Tori, I just have to disagree with you about this idea that this is not high stakes poker, because, you know, as any poker player knows, if you're bluffing on a weak hand, you have to keep raising the stakes and the ante, and you can't show any idea that you have any weakness at all, because that's the only way you can get the other side to fold. And Putin he's risking a lot of high costs here, both in the sanctions that could be levied against him, and if he actually tries to take over all of Ukraine, could be a very bloody conflict, could be a lot of Russian troops coming home in body bags. They could be facing a long-term insurgency. What Putin would really like to do is convince Ukraine it really has no choice but to capitulate. And his ideal scenario is that he gets what he wants without having to have a full-scale war. And that requires him to act like he's willing to go to the mat and do everything. So I think it is really much, I think it's very equivalent to bluffing in a very high-stakes poker game.
TBD. TBD. Okay, now we're going to segue to segment B, which was inspired also by Jamie, and actually kind of about books, which is also unusual for us. Literary comfort food. We're going to get to Jack Reacher, Jamie, but literary comfort food. And there was an article, I think it was the New York Times recently, talking about literary comfort food. When is there such a thing as guilty pleasure reading? If so, is it okay? If so, what are you reading? Those kinds of things. So Rodney first, literary comfort food, yes or no? If so, for you, what is it for you?
Oh, wow. Absolutely. I'm a big believer in literary comfort food. And like all comfort food, it ranges from the absolutely abominable from a health perspective, you know, the fried pork rinds of comfort food, to high class comfort food, you know, pigs in a blanket, right? Which, you know, you can gussy up and make a little more presentable. So I like to read on the higher end of that spectrum. I like to read things like sports biographies that I read recently, the biography of Hank Aaron, which was fantastic. And it's not, I'm not going to learn a lot about the Ukraine, you know, the Russian Ukrainian conflict, but it's fascinating, right? A glimpse into a time and a place, and he was my childhood hero. So, of course, I'm going to read that book.
That's good.
And then there's the fried pork rinds of this genre, and I have fortunately not read. I've been off of pork rinds, both literally and figuratively, for a while. But you know, back in the day, I loved a little Robert Ludlum, and I loved Jack Reacher. I was a big Jack Reacher fan, right? And And so, you know, I followed with all sorts of interest the casting of Jack Reacher when they cast the short guy, right? And the big debate.
Tom Cruise.
You know, Jack Reacher is like 6'8" and like 280 with 3% body fat. And they cast Tom Cruise. Come on.
That's 5'7".
Okay.
Yeah, 5'7". So anyway, that's my view. Absolutely on literary comfort food.
Okay, good. Rodney and I have not talked about this, but Rodney, this is an awesome segue to Jamie, because Jamie's comfort food is Jack Reacher. And several days ago, he and I were trading texts. He says, please let me talk about Jack Reacher and Tom Cruise and the new Amazon series. Jamie, the stage is yours for at least.
I'm not breaking any big news here, because this has been all over the internet. Everybody's been very excited that the casting of Alan Ritchson as the new Jack Reacher just fits the character to a T. And you know, but backtracking,
he's over 6 feet for starters. Yeah,
what's that?
Alan's much taller for starters.
Well, he's only 6'2" actually, and but you know, you can make people look bigger, even bigger than they are on the screen, as you know, has been the case with Tom Cruise, who's the same height as my wife. But you know, this idea of comfort food is, I've asked myself this many times, why do I keep reading some of the same books over and over again when I clearly don't have time to read all the books I want to read? But so why waste my time reading things over again? Because it's comfort food. And there's a whole host of authors that I just enjoy. I mean, I still go back and read P.G. Wodehouse because I just find him, it's so delightful. And, you know, it's kind of like light beer. It's less filling, but it also, you know, it also gets the job done. And I've gone through a lot of authors over time that I have considered literary comfort food, including the whole Janet Ivanovich series. You know, even my science fiction phase where I read all of Isaac Asimov's stories, I considered those comfort food. My all-time favorite author, John D. MacDonald, who I've mentioned before, who created a character somewhat like Jack Reacher, a kind of knight errant who goes around correcting wrongs. And then I fell into the Lee Child series of Jack Reacher. And, you know, you have to admit up front that it's not really a realistic, you know, it's not gritty realism, because Jack Reacher is a good guy who colors outside the lines, but he always wins. And, you know, in a world where it sometimes seems like the bad guys are always winning, it's nice to immerse yourself in a world where, you know, ultimately the good guy is going to win. And the part about casting Alan Ritchson in the part, an actor who I wasn't familiar with, although he's been around for a while, is that he was able to capture the sort of the essential qualities of Jack Reacher. And this is why fans have reacted so positively to his casting. One of them is that Jack Reacher doesn't talk a lot. And in the very first episode of Reacher on Amazon, they managed to go through the first, I don't know, 10 minutes or so with him not uttering a line. But one of the challenges they had to overcome is that in the books, we hear what Jack Reacher is thinking because it's in the first person. And so to adapt that to the screen, you have to either have like a voiceover where you hear the character's thoughts like they do in, say, Dexter. If anybody's watching Dexter, Dexter's constantly hear the off camera narration of what he's thinking. Or as they've done in Reacher, they've got to have some point where he actually explains to other people what he's thinking. And he has this unique combination of sort of Sherlock Holmes, you know, deductive reasoning, where he's able to figure things out. And he's always the smartest guy in the room. And, you know, it's a fantasy character. It's a male fantasy character. Everybody would like to be Jack Reacher. I think Lee Child actually said he'd like to be Jack Reacher, the author.
Most importantly, and now we're going to wrap, Jamie, do you want to be Jack Reacher?
Every guy would fantasize that he's Jack Reacher. And the part that was left out of the Tom Cruise movies was all the stuff that made him such a unique character, like the fact that he doesn't actually have any sort of address and doesn't have any clothes. When his clothes get dirty, he just throws them away and goes to a used clothing, Salvation Army store and buys some new duds. And doesn't care about what he looks like in the clothes. It's a great adaptation. I don't have to tell Jack Reacher fans that because they flooded to the Amazon series. It was renewed for a second season in a record like 3 days. So
there you go. Great recommendations. Okay. 6:21, 1 minute past. Okay. We are now going to shift to our wonderful author this evening. So Chill, Alice. So Chill, welcome to Chatter on Books. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's so nice to get to hear all of you chattering about other things.
So we do. Usually you're spared. Usually it's 10, 15 minutes of sports, whatever is going on in the world of sports. Please say hi to Rodney Ferguson, Jamie McIntyre, Claude Jen, doing all the important work.
Here. We didn't talk about sports so much because the only thing that happened was the worst Olympics ever.
Ever.
Ever. A very sad ever. Olympics.
Ever.
A very sad Olympics.
We could go on forever, but I so want to talk about this book. And Jamie and Ronnie, don't let me go on and on and on because I tend to monopolize this section of the show, which I don't want to. So it's fabulous. I said before we started rolling tonight, I started reading it and I couldn't stop.
Oh my gosh, thank you.
I were traveling recently and I had it with me. And say we were supposed to leave at 8 o'clock in the morning, I'd be reading the book and he'd want to be going out the door. And I'd say, oh, wait, I just need to finish this. And I'm carrying it down the stairs. I mean, absolutely fabulous. And we're going to talk lots about it, but let's talk about you. I loved your bio. The author bios are so just sterile and boring. But yours absolutely fascinated me. You describe yourself as an entrepreneur, a wedding planner, which has an impact in the book, a fundraiser, and this is fabulous, a tarot card reader.
Yes.
Just a tarot card reader. How does one become a tarot card reader? Did you have a little neon sign outside?
No, I used to read in high school, and then I don't remember what got me to, I think I actually just saw a deck that was so pretty and I bought it and I picked it up again. And then I randomly just, at first I had this idea and I set up a table outside of my house. And I just sort of like whoever came by in Brooklyn on this little street in Brooklyn and my friends would come by and it turned into like a little block party and people would come and get their tarot read and we'd have rosé and nice days in the spring. And then I had, I lived in the same neighborhood for so long. One of my friends owned a wine bar and she's like, you should come in and read at the wine bar. And then because I knew all of these event planners, I would get booked for private parties. So like for very, 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 very wealthy people, I've read tarot at some very influential hedge fund holiday parties. So, and it was really a fun, it's a fun way to learn a lot about people. You get, it's a lot is revealed in what the querent's question is to you. And so, I think all of those things make you a good reader of people altogether.
Rodney and Jamie, have you ever had this done? Have you ever had someone read tarot cards for you?
I'm terrified of it. No, I'm afraid of what they'll find. Oh no, all that dread I felt all those years,
right.
It wasn't misplaced. So no, I have not. I'm fascinated by this, though. As Tori may know, in our neighborhood on Connecticut Avenue in Chevy Chase, which is a lot of wealthy people.
Yeah.
On Main Drag, there's a house, a really nice house, and it says out front, psychic. And a big sign, which is a little like going to Palm Beach and seeing somebody hanging a pig renderer sign out of their window or something. It's just not the done thing. So I'm like tempted, Tori, to stop the next time I'm on Connecticut Avenue and say, hey, come on, tell me a little about how I'm going to meet my demise here, but I haven't gotten the courage yet. So
in the category of 6 degrees of separation. So I know Rodney, so Chill, because his sister-in-law is one of my best friends from back in college days. And she and I were both journalism students at GW, the stupidest major anyone has ever picked. And we were the stupidest people in a stupid major. And it was a feature writing class. And you had to write feature stories, of course. And the head of whoever the teacher was says, okay, you can go and write about whatever you want, but whatever you do, don't wander up Connecticut Avenue and decide you're going to interview some tarot card reader or a psychic. And just don't do it. It's the worst ever. It's the worst ever. So what does Lorraine go out and do? She goes and wanders, into Georgetown. I'm sure it was into Georgetown. And it was a disaster. And I think she didn't do well on the on the paper.
Oh, no.
In fact, I think she's one short credit short of graduating. So we'll
blame it on that. Yeah.
Okay. Still stick with your background. Iowa Writers Workshop. We've had lots of authors on, and I really, one of these days, I want to get someone on who works at and helps run the Iowa Writers Workshop, because it has produced incredible people. So what was the experience like for you? How did it help your writing? Was it the single most important thing in your career that you've done?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I went back to school. I went to my 20th college reunion in May, and then I started Iowa that August. So I had not been in school for 20 years. And so it was a particularly unique experience to me, in the sense that I think at 42, you have a really different sense of time and two academic years. It's a completely funded program. So it's free to go. And then I was given a stipend to live. So I didn't have to work for the first year or teach or anything, just write. And so more than anything, I think it was the time and the creative space without distractions that sort of makes some magic kind of happen. And then you're around very smart people that have really great insights and wonderful established writers that are faculty, like Sam Chang, who runs the program. But I think I went in with a sort of a sense of urgency, because I was like, well, you only have two academic years. Time, I think, in your 40s has a different sense of quickness than it does maybe in your 20s.
Just wait till you get to your 60s.
Yeah. And so I kind of went in and was like, you've only got but so much time, and you've got to come in one way and come out with a career. And so I felt a sense of urgency about it. And I definitely took it very seriously that way. And so I finished the book my first semester. I sold at the beginning of my second semester. And by the time I graduated, I was going into pre-production for my pilot adaptation. So I was very, very busy during those 2 years. Yeah. But it's a magical place, Iowa City, for writing. It really is. Like I kind of want to get myself invited back to teach so I can work on another book.
Okay. But born and bred and lived in Brooklyn, how did you find Iowa City?
Oh my God. It's like a void. Well, actually the second year I taught, it was great.
All three listeners from Iowa. I just want
to know. It was a bit of a void. I mean, just in the sense that, like, you would walk outside and you wouldn't see people for blocks. Like, you could go and walk and not encounter anyone. And I realized it was wonderful. The second year I taught, and, you know, we have this, you have a vision of like what a public school, a public college. I worked at Hunter College, which is like congested and very, like, you know, extremely diverse. And, you know, and I remember my first day of class, like one of my class was almost completely all white students from Iowa. And three of them were like, you know, I was so nervous about moving to the city. And I was thinking, what city? And then like halfway through, I was like, oh, they mean Iowa City. But so like, it's all relative. It was just like, to me, I'm so used to congestion. And then at the end, I kind of just dug it. I mean, it's like very peaceful. It's very chill. Like, it's Big Ten school. So like the night before a game is like a big night. And the students, I mean, my students there were just magnificent, you know, just so curious and eager. And so it was fun to like, I mean, you could go very easily if you were from New York without ever living in the Midwest. And I think it was a good thing to kind of have that experience. And they really respect writers there. Like, it was really wild. Like, it's very wild. Like, people know that you're at the workshop and they're just sort of very like into it and into books.
Do you think people from the people who run it, would they come on a show like ours and just talk about it? Or is it
Sam Chang has a new book out. And so she probably would come on. It's wonderful. And it's fabulous. It's about a Chinese American family in Iowa. So it's really, really cool. It's a fabulous book too. The Family Chow. It's wonderful.
Excellent. All right. Should we talk about your fabulous book?
Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
By the way, Jamie, would you like to ask the penultimate Jamie McIntyre?
I was just wondering, it was weird, the, you know, 29 minute mark here. And I was just thinking, I always like to ask this particular probing question. So Chiel, what is the book about?
Yeah, it's about liberation and love and family. And I think it's mainly about liberation of self and of place and, you know, kind of finding your own, making your way out from under what you think you're supposed to be and just being who you are and finding some sense of self-love and love for others out of that. So I think of it as a middle-age coming of age story. You know, it's like a midlife coming of age story. And you know, it's about family and about a brother and a sister, and they're reckoning with their mother having abandoned them, and then kind of finally having to come to terms with how they really feel about that and finding acceptance for who they really are after sort of leading successful lives that look great from the outside, but maybe are not so sturdy on the inside. And
without giving away any, you know, without any spoilers, can you give us a quick idea of the plot?
Sure. Yeah. It's we meet Olga Acevedo, who's a wedding planner to the very wealthy, in 2017, just, you know, a few months before Hurricane Maria hits Puerto Rico. And her brother is a very popular Brooklyn congressman, and his name is Prieto Acevedo. And they're from a couple generations deep Puerto Rican Brooklyn family. And they had been left by their mother, who was a radical socialist activist, and left for her to pursue politics. And they were raised by their grandparents. And she comes barreling into their lives on the heels of Hurricane Maria. And a lot of sort of kind of family secrets come to the fold. Olga, there's a romance. So there's a bit of a love story there. And it really sort of explores disaster capitalism in Puerto Rico after Maria, and kind of the hyper gentrification going on in Brooklyn now too. So there's definitely a political geopolitical kind of component to it.
There are so many wonderful threads that run through it. Rodney, should we, a brief commercial break to talk about the drink that Rodney, Rodney has a real very important job in life, so chill, but he is the celebrity mixologist for Chatter on Books. And he crafted a cocktail to go along with Olga Dies Dreaming, which I have been nursing, but nursing it was not good enough, Rodney.
You look at me. There you go.
It's done.
I said pace yourself. One every 30 minutes is not pacing yourself, Tori, for both of us. What's that, Tori?
You want to talk about your drink?
Yeah, sure, of course. So, Jill, it's lovely to meet you, and I look forward to reading the book. I confess I haven't yet because I've been too busy concocting a cocktail in honor of you and the book, and it's been time consuming and emotionally draining, but now I think I've reached it. So what we had tonight was, and I'm going to butcher so many things in the next 5 minutes that I blanket apology up front. First is my Spanish, which is non-existent, but I wanted to think of a cocktail which would combine the various elements that you write about in your book. And I did do enough research to know what the book was about, and whatnot. So the name of this cocktail is called the Hungier. And as I understand it, that is sort of Puerto Rican slang for hangout.
Yes.
To hang out. So you can think about this cocktail.
Are we good so far, Sucio? We've not insulted.
No, nobody's been insulted. That's okay.
Nobody's been insulted. Stop me if I do.
Yeah, me too.
It's called the Hungier, which I'm told is sort of a Puerto Rican slang, and particularly among Puerto Ricans in New York, for it translates to the hangout, right? So this cocktail is a variation on a classic, old classic cocktail called the Brooklyn.
Oh, cool.
But what I wanted to do is sort of localize or sort of give it a twist that would be relevant to you and your experience. So the primary ingredient, the base liquor in this is rye, except for this one, I substituted Puerto Rican rum.
Awesome.
And so the Hungier has two parts Puerto Rican rum, one part dry vermouth, and then a quarter part of a very interesting liqueur called Golden Moon, which is a little bit like a liqueur, a little bit like an aperitivo, and then a quarter part maraschino liqueur.
Ooh.
The maraschino is not hard to find. Golden Moon's a little hard to find. But they have it at Ace Beverage here in Washington, D.C. on New Mexico Avenue. Run, don't walk. And then you combine this and stir it a lot with ice, get it nice and cold, pour it in a coupe glass. That's important, not a tumbler.
Chilled glasses are very important. As a former wedding planner, glasses are very important, yes.
Exactly. A chilled coupe, and then with a cherry. I'm a Luxardo fan, and then enjoy. And it's, I found it, you know, not that I'm you know, falsely humble, I found it delicious. So I would as well. So anyway.
It's absolutely wonderful. It's a good thing I only made one.
Well, yeah. I have to try it. I'm very intimidated by my home mixology, but I'm going to try it because it sounds delicious.
Yeah, do not be intimidated. It is, you know, there. You know, the best thing about home mixology, there are no mistakes.
That's really good.
You can't make a mistake.
And no witnesses, even if there are. So that's great.
You make a mistake, you drink it. It has the same outcome, right? So don't be intimidated.
You just keep making them until they start.
I had to try four of these before I got it right, you know, and I had a great night. So, yeah. Okay. So anyway, in honor of you, the hungier.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it so much.
And I'll try my act together and post the recipe because it is really, really good.
Okay.
So awesome. Glasses are important to a wedding planner. Glasses are important to Olga and Olga Dies Dreaming. And it's hard to explain that a book that starts out with how napkins are folded for a very high-end fancy wedding can lead to this story that it has so many threads running through it. So there is the thread of Olga really finding herself. And there's a great line in there about she kind of mixed up the American dream, making money with fame, and she's never going to make that mistake again. She changes throughout the story. Her brother, the congressman, changes throughout the story. Their relationship with the mother, which is incredible, changes throughout the story. So process is a bad word, but I love talking to authors about the process. What was the process for you? Did those threads appear and manifest themselves in your writing organically? Or did you sit down with a flow chart? I think Claude might remember, I think Rebecca Sachs was an Iowa Writers Workshop person. She wrote this great book called 1,000 Gates. And she had this system, Socio, in her apartment, and we had pictures of it where she would have string running in multiple layers around index cards, flow charts, those kinds of things. Ken Follett, the other end of the spectrum of writing, uses Excel spreadsheets. But was the process for you more organic or was it more linear?
The first draft was really organic. And I mean, and I was halfway through the first draft when I got to Iowa and I finished it like in October. So I from August to October, I finished it. But the first draft was very organic. Like I sort of was like, I think the mom's going to communicate through letters. And then I was like, she needs a brother. And then like, you know, it found itself. But then what I did do is like, there's this thing that I learned about there, which is like lines of tension, you know, and actually Sam Chang was teaching a novel workshop. And what she showed us was she had plotted out the lines of tension in the Brothers Karamazov. And so even though you don't revisit everything that has tension, every chapter, it's always, if you look at it even. And so I did end up making a spreadsheet at first by hand, and then I did it by, and there were something like 30 lines of tension in the book. And I think it ended up being like 100 and something chapters because they're very short little chapters, you know, they're all titled, all the chapters, and the title has to do with the theme. But like, and I did look at it and I plotted it out as a graph so that I could see that it was all even. And if something needed to be moved up or if I'd lost something, you know, like it was, like, we hadn't talked about, she has a cousin Mabel. That's like a very minor point, but I was like, we haven't talked about Mabel in a little bit and I need to go in and finesse that. So a lot of work in terms of making it function from a literary quality standpoint happened in revision. But the story, I always say, like, I think that, you know, the art of writing happens in drafting and the craft happens in revision, right? So you know, it was really pretty vomitous. Like I was on a train to Providence because I'm an alum at Brown and I'm on an advisory council to the president there. And I go back and forth a lot. So I was on an Amtrak and I was like, the mom's going to write in letters. And so then I wrote the letter. Like it started out with her going to meeting the hoarder. And then I added in, I was like, oh, we should meet her at work. And then I had the idea about the napkins right away. And so the beginning sort of found itself in a lot of ways. And then revision really helped kind of make it function, if that makes sense. Like, so that you can do, because I do try to do a lot of crazy things in this book, you know, like,
it's one of the most wonderful things about this book is just when you think, okay, it's on a certain pace or a certain rhythm. And then, I'm jumping out of order here, so I apologize for this, but the letters from the mother. So this is not given that the mother has abandoned the two of them when they were both quite young, and they're both working out their relationship with her in absentia.
Yes.
Got a really interesting role in Puerto Rico. the letters from her were devastatingly honest. She was very transparent on what she wanted and what she wanted them to do.
Yeah.
And I was putting myself in their shoes thinking, oh my God, if I got a letter like that from my mother, my letters from my mother, like growing up in my many failed careers, was like, oh, come on, you're going to be okay, right? That's what you want from your mother. And that's not what they were getting, Olga and her brother were getting from her. But where did that idea come from? And were those letters hard to write? Because I found them hard to read.
The letters were the thing that I probably revised the most. I probably rewrote those all the most. They were at times hard to write, but I think, you know, it's been interesting. Like, I considered her such an extreme case. My mother's a brutally honest person. My mother's mother was a brutally honest person. Like, it's like it runs in the family. I sort of considered her an extreme case. And I did a book club for like an online Latina book club. And it was like 50 women and everybody was like, it was my mother. So I don't know if it's just like culturally, like we're used to not getting sugarcoated, but I did want, you know, I think this idea, I wanted to explore this idea of like lineage that I think we think is just something that fathers care about. But the idea of like, I have a legacy and I'm proud of the things that I've done. And I thought you were going to carry on in my footsteps. Like your job is to like, you know, and I always, there's this great line that I thought about a lot when I was reading this in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, where Sidney Poitier's father says, you're my like son, you're supposed to be doing this. And he was like, I didn't ask to be born, but this idea that you are supposed to have some control over what your kids do. I found that really interesting. And I wanted to have a mom that sort of they see themselves as successes and she sort of sees it as like a failing,
wasn't the success she wanted. Okay. This thing about process fascinates me. So Jamie, different kind of writing in your career and in journalism, is there a process that you follow each time? Jamie and I knew each other years ago. So Gio working at the Pentagon, was there a certain battle rhythm that you went through every time when you were working on a story that you had to go on air that night?
Or so journalism is so different because it's so immediate and it's, was famously referred to by the publisher of the Washington Post as the first, you know, draft of history. And you just kind of go with your gut. Mm-hmm. You don't have a lot of time to think about it. But I tell you, I would be interested in hearing more from Sachil about her background. And I don't mean to sound impertinent, but, you know, like what qualifies you to bring this story to? Because it just I could tell, by the way, you said Puerto Rico, that that you had some background in this. So I would just be interested to hear more about that.
Yeah. I mean, I was raised by my maternal grandparents in Brooklyn, and my parents had met. They were both in the Brown Power movement. You know, so my mom was like fought for Black and Puerto Rican studies at CUNY and was part of like the takeover of the CUNY system, like in the early, like late 60s. And then she went on to go to Puerto Rico and like fight for reparations for the sterilization experiments that had been going on down there. And then eventually made her way out to California and was working on union stuff. And that's where she met my dad. And I was left when I was much younger with my grandparents because she was like going all throughout Latin America, trying to organize people and running for political office as like, you know, like a minor candidate, like a super minor candidate in any of these races, like a write-in. Like my grandfather voted for her for everything. Like that was like her, I mean, no, she got that vote. And so I sort of was fascinated, you know, then I ended up going to Brown and I majored in art history there and I got back and I was like working in like a kind of a weird gallery. And like, you know, I was like, what were my concerns were like, how can I get into this party in the Hamptons this weekend? And like, and my mother and I are not close at all, but I did find it fascinating. And she was so unimpressed with me going to Brown. And I remember like she read my thesis won like this giant prize at Brown, my art history thesis. And she read it and she's like, oh, it's bourgeois nonsense. Like,
she read your book now?
Yes, she thought that it was very good and that the mother character was intriguing. That's what she said. it's a great relationship. But I laughed really hard because I just found it interesting, you know, like and then I was like making my living, like kind of catering to all these very wealthy people. And she like could be, there's nothing I could have done less to impress her other than having gone to Brown. Like she's like, you know, so I found that dichotomy though, in general, really interesting of like, you know, people like that generation kind of fighting to like open things up. And then the next generation being very much like into materialism, you know, and like I graduated from college and I wanted to go to Balthazar and get Cosmos and buy Manolo Blahniks with my bonus. So like, you know, like I think like all of those things and I just found that generational thing interesting. And I really wanted to write about, sometimes it takes you a while to kind of look at that stuff. And I wanted to write about that like particular experience of like being of mid age and like having an assessment of like, I don't know, like, you know, like, and maybe I don't even know how I ended up here. And I found that fascinating. So
isn't it always the case though, or not, maybe it's not always the case, but it was my case, that the mothers are somewhat miserly in handing out praise. I remember, if I for a moment can tell a personal story. In the early 1990s, I landed the job at CNN to be the Pentagon correspondent, and I called my mother, who lived in Alexandria, and I told her, Mom, I got this great new assignment. I'm going to be covering the Pentagon for CNN. And she said, well, what will that lead to? She said, and I said, well, you know, it's a pretty prestigious beat. And she said, so do you think you'll be Secretary of Defense someday? And I said, Mom, I hardly think being the Pentagon correspondent would qualify you to be Secretary of Defense. She said, so what, you have no ambition? My mom was Jewish, in case you couldn't tell. I had no ambition.
We can all tell mom stories. Rodney's sister-in-law, Lorraine Bowles, my pal, G.W. Dace, was my my maid of honor at our wedding. And it's before the wedding at this stupid church, and we're in the little hut and we're getting dressed, and my mom was there. My mom was spectacular. And Lori, as I know her, anybody pre-1980 knows her as Lori, says, is with my mom. And she goes, oh my God, doesn't she look great? Kind of waving towards me. And my mom goes, who? Oh my God, so great. Okay, but you're selling yourself short, Jill, because I tend to read a book and I'll keep one hand on my Google machine, and I know just enough about the very uncomfortable relationship, to put it nicely, between Puerto Rico and Washington. And you nailed it. I mean, you nailed it, and you nailed what the politicians were doing and what the businesses were doing and the control board, and you nailed it throughout. And the first few times I checked it, I thought, okay. And then near the end of the book, I thought, well, she must have gotten tired by now. She's not, but no, you nailed it. Are you completely familiar with that? Have you always been completely familiar?
I have been, I think as you might imagine, I was kind of made aware of certain political things just because of who my parents were and what they were interested in. I have a baby book. It's called Marx for Beginners that my father sent me when I was five.
For Beginners.
Yeah, it's illustrated. So, there's like a little shelf of these things.
Illustrated?
Oh yeah, it's illustrated.
Oh God!
It's like comic style. I've got to find it. It's by a guy named Rias. It's not really a children's book, but it is very easy to understand. Anyway, I sort of had always had it on my radar, and then I think what it was I was very, to me, I don't know. I guess like it's like I'm like the type of person where I feel like if something is wrong, then shouldn't it be wrong across the board? And I think this idea of like, you know, there'd been so much chatter about voting rights and all this stuff. And this was like around the 2016 election. And I'd been a big volunteer on the Hillary campaign. And I was at the Javits Center chatting with people early on in the night. And no one knew that Puerto Rico was part of the United States. Yeah. And I'm like, and I think in this like super liberal like room, I was like, if this is so, and yet everybody is talking about, you know, getting into like voting rights and, you know, restitution of rights for felons. And I was like, and those things are important, but so is the idea that you've got people that are kind of citizens and like, you know, and like that this should just generally bother us, you know, like, and I think so it was very much on my radar. And honestly, the intention was less to write a love story about a wedding planner than it really was. I was like, can I Trojan horse this and make people, because I would, if I tweeted something about, you know, Promesa, this oversight board that's appointed corporate raiders, basically that are take control of the finances of Puerto Rico. Nobody, unless they're Puerto Rican or Puerto Rican scholar or whatever, like is interested in that. And I was like, you have to humanize it in a way that isn't disaster porn, which is what kind of happened after Maria, and that is also kind of lets you get and understand what's also happening after, you know, and now we're seeing it. There's so many protests happening right now around Prop 60, because that essentially has allowed people to come not just from America, but from all over and move and take over coastal land and not pay any taxes. And so what's happening is people, there's no services, schools are underfunded, teachers aren't being compensated properly, and everyone's leaving for the mainland and the island's being left like to be literally taken over by non-Boricuas. So it really is getting to be an untenable place. I think it was just interesting that this, the publication of the book has time to all of this. As I was writing it, I had to add in like the protests that were happening in the streets, you know, like I was like, yeah, like, and so it was something that's very much concerned me, not just because it's my background, but just kind of, I don't know. I just feel like if we care about something, shouldn't we care about it across the board? Like, and that, you know, this should sort of just be an American issue that's of concern to us, that, you know, how do we resolve this? Because this shouldn't be considered something that we just let go, you know, indefinitely. And it's been over 100 and something years now. So.
Yeah. I really love your optimism and your hope for people, but I remember about, it's probably 15, 20 years ago now, National Geographic or something like that, for some reason, did a survey of U.S. postal workers.
Yeah.
And something like, I'm not far off on the number here, something like 65, 70% of U.S. postal workers thought New Mexico was another country.
Oh, yeah. Those things always get me so sad. No, I'm like, I'm going to be haunted by this now.
Happier note, let's get out with this before we do 60 seconds more with Xochitl. Without giving anything away, Olga becomes more of an activist.
Yes.
And gets some, you know, some loving from her mom, which she was clearly looking for. Do you see yourself in your career becoming more of an activist for any cause?
You know, my second novel, I'm in the middle of my second novel now. And I think what I think it is that I don't want to just write books for the sake of creating emotions. I want to write books that are provocative. And I think that I tend to find political things provocative. So I don't know where that will go. I think I don't want to say artists should be apolitical, but I think of myself primarily as an artist. I think it's just more that coming my worldview and my world experience, I do see the built-in inequities and things, and I like to call some attention to that. And if that shifts a mindset, I think that's part of the process. It's partially why I was interested in adapting it for television, because I thought that it was a different way of seeing Puerto Ricans and Latinos on TV that I think does start to change the way that people see and perceive a culture as being less othered, for instance.
Okay, I lied. What can you tell us about the TV adaptation, and do we get invited to the red carpet premiere?
Yeah, because I'll give it as many things as I can. We shot a pilot. It's fabulous. Aubrey Plaza plays Olga Acevedo, and Jesse Williams plays her love interest, who many people know him from Grey's, and Ramon Rodriguez, who is in The Wire and The Affair, plays Prieto, and he's amazing. And Wanda de Jesus plays the mother, Blanca. So we have an amazing cast. We are trying to now find it its home for the rest of the season, and we are pretty, Hulu produced the pilot, but it's not going to land at Hulu. So we're sort of now, I'm in the business of my other hat now, my new biography is like, I'm also now a television producer. So by the way, I have to laugh because if you want to see people's faces deflate, tell a Hollywood executive that's worked their whole lives to do something that it's just like wedding planning, and you will never see people like defeated. It is not, I was like, you should never say that again. That is not the thing to say, apparently. But they're like, are you overwhelmed? And it's kind of like wedding planning.
That is great. Thank you so much for writing it. Thank you so much for being with us. The book is Olga Die Streaming. Everyone should go out to their favorite independent bookstore and get a copy of it, which is fabulous, and buy several for friends. And I want to thank Claude for doing all the important work, Jamie for being with us from his bat cave, wherever that, you know.
Exactly, yes. It's in the sub basement of my house.
Sub basement. Rodney, the drink's going into the library of Rodney's Finest because it's really, really good. And everybody, thank you for listening, downloading us, for those nice reviews. Please, again, if you've got nothing better to do, just go spend 2 minutes on Apple iTunes and write us a nice review, maybe about this show, because Xochitl was so fabulous. And we are off next week, and then we're back in early March with Lee Kravitz, who is the author of The Last Confessions of Sylvia P. It is fabulous. He's this hot young whatever. It will be great. Everybody stay well, keep listening, and we'll see you soon. Thanks.